Welcome back to New World Next Week. I'm James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And I'm James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. Kids can't tie their shoes anymore, not even the fifth graders. We have that horrifying story, plus depopulation architect joins the calls. But first, what way do we talk about World War III this week? Iran appears to have conducted significant cyber attack against a U.S. company, a first, possibly, since the war started. Grabbing this from NBC News, everything we say is always linked up and proved down in the show notes. An Iran-linked hacker group has claimed responsibility for a cyber attack on a medical tech company in what appears to be the first significant instance of Iran's hacking an American company since the start of the latest war between the two countries. The company Stryker, with a Y, headquartered in Michigan, produces a range of medical equipment and technology. Won't someone please think of the medical industrial complex? Historically, Iran has conducted some of the most infamous wiper cyber attacks on national enemies, aiming to simply erase all the data on computer networks. Victims include Saudi Aramco, Saudi Arabia's national oil company, back in 2012, and the Sands Casino in 2014. But I recall Obama and Israel feeding Stuxnet into nuclear plants, which strikes me as a tad more dangerous than some rigged casino. I don't know. Since the war started, some established hacker groups sympathetic to Iranian leadership have claimed minor attacks, but most have been relegated to briefly altering the appearance of a website, which sounds quaint and classic now in 2026, and none appear to have had major impact. Some tech and cybersecurity companies, including Google and the email cybersecurity company Proofpoint, have told NBC Comcast News they've largely seen Iran's hackers conducting espionage related to the war. But that appears to have changed with what appears to have been a different type of attack that also deleted information from devices. A Stryker employee who requested, "Don't say who I am, I'm not supposed to be running my mouth," said that employees' work-issued phones stopped working, grinding work and communications with colleagues to a standstill. I guess it stopped short of locking their doors and they couldn't scan to get back into their offices or out of the elevators. Stryker says it's restoring systems after pro-Iran hackers wiped thousands of employee devices, as the U.S. cyber assault on Iran before the bombing hasn't stopped the hackers, James. And these are the ones that we know about.
Yeah, exactly right. And so I don't have anything to really add color commentary wise to this story other than to say exactly what we've been saying for close to 20 years on this very subject is, yep, some things happen in the digital domain. They say it's Iran-linked hackers, and we just have to believe them. Or not, I suppose. Those are our choices, because how the hell do we know? Yeah, okay, I guess there was some kind of thing that happened with Stryker's network, but who was it? It was an Iran-linked group? How did you link that exactly? And how do we know? And whose server logs are we getting to peruse to get in the bare bones of this? Again, all of this is just like everything else in the digital space, it's just whatever, who knows. So yes, but you're exactly right. Yeah, every week I think at this point it's just what aspect of World War III do we want to cover in this non-live, non-breaking news up to the minute news show. Well, we have to cover some aspect of this crazy unfolding event. So I think the cyber attack is relatively underreported at the moment, but that's probably because they're setting all of the pieces in place for the gigantic, spectacular punch in the face book that we know is coming, right? And of course, we'll know it's those Iranians, I tell you, who did it. Not to say that I think the government of Iran is some, you know, wonderful utopia that should be, you know, defended in the, you know, general sense of, oh my God, I'm glad they're ruling over their people. An example of that, this coming from the Register, Iran's chosen users get privileged access despite internet blackout for masses, noting that Iran's internet uptime went from 100% uptime in the days preceding the strikes to just above 0% thereafter. And so now the only way the average Iranian can get access to the internet at all is through some either sketchy VPN relay of illegal Starlink signal, or if somebody's on the border who happens to be able to pass the network through the border, which, you know, obviously the Iranian government is cracking down on. So yes, of course, what is the first casualty of any war? It's truth. And so governments around the world will all act the same. They will all try to plunge their masses into darkness, literal and metaphorical, in the event of war. And Iran is doing that to its chosen users as well. So there's that. But then The narrative continues to unfold. I have this from the past couple of days. EU sanctions Iranian cyber front over election meddling Charlie Hebdo breach. So the Council of the European Union is sanctioning something called Eminet Pasargad, which is a front for a series of Iranian cyber attacks. Again, trust us, bros. And apparently they attempted interference with U.S. elections and attacked the subscribers of French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo by hacking their subscriber logs and releasing them to the dark web. So anyway, make of that false flag, question mark, what you will. But even over here in East Asia, Japan's now getting into the act. Japan to allow proactive cyber defense from October 1st. And of course, the wisecrackers at the register had the subhead on that one. In less polite spaces, places, this is called hacking back or offensive psyops. So yes, they have, Japan is now basically approving offensive cyber operations, which I'm sure they've been doing, but now it's officially they're doing it. So there you go. So the cyber war is unfolding. There is a cyber war aspect to what is happening right now. Even if it is just the implanting of the narrative of cyber warfare, it is becoming a more important part of this fifth generation war on everyone that is World War III, that is already happening, regardless of what's happening on the geopolitical table. And let's always keep in mind, it's always governments against their own citizens.
And they want us to identify with my country, to those people over there. Again, we're all pretty much usually pawns under the rule of. And I heard you say it. Everybody out there, you heard him. Only the chosen ones get the internet. But yeah, I mean, the guy that signed an executive order to increase production of glyphosate said that Iran is evil. So, you know, I got to go with that, right? Hey, at least it wasn't exploding pagers. 16 years ago this week on New World Next Week, James, I sent you this yesterday, and it was like, bam, what about a synchronicity? New World Next Week flashback, virtual flag terrorism, black cyber operations on the rise. March 18th, 2010, 16 years ago this week on New World Next Week. And we're going to have to go back through some of those early ones, because I don't even have numbers on the earliest New World Next Week episodes. And James, maybe we just do this show live moving into the future at some point. Just a thought. That's how we get going on New World Next Week, episode 623. Our second story, not really a story so much as it's just sad notes from teachers on the front lines. James, and we were talking about public schools a little bit before we started rolling tape on this episode. Back in the Smiths days, I didn't mention Morrissey at all last week, there was a song called The Headmaster Ritual about how abusive all the teachers and coaches were at school, beating you up and all the horrible things that happened there. 15 years later, he's solo, and of course times had changed, and he has a song, solo record, called The Teachers Are Afraid of the Pupils. A noticeable decline. Teachers sharing the everyday things students can't do for themselves anymore. They can't read, write, or spell, and don't care. This is coming from BuzzFeed, who apparently posted up an article, 25 teachers sharing the basic things students apparently can't do themselves anymore. And once that story hit, even more people started to pile on. In response to that, I teach 3K. These are 3- and 4-year-olds, and most of our kids cannot put a jacket on at all. They won't even try. They start throwing tantrums before even attempting, saying they can't do it. It's too hard. The majority of students struggle to read a clock unless it's digital. Kids know they will pass no matter how unqualified, ill-equipped, and unprepared they are. They come to school with the attitude, I won't do the work, and you can't make me. So, sad to say, we can't. That's why I quit teaching. Call me a coward. I blame it on No Child Left Behind. It's always those Republicans. I have been shocked by the number of second and third graders who can't tie their shoes. I also have fourth graders who can't write their first and last names. It's really scary to think a kid can get to fourth grade without anyone raising an alarm about their inability to write their full name. I've been teaching high school English for only 7 years now, and the post-COVID lockdown emotional landscape is rough. Students are using AI to think for them, write for them, and summarize any readings for them that are longer than a paragraph. We've put technology in every classroom, but kids don't understand how to use it. Now, isn't that interesting? Doesn't that seem to fly in the face of, oh, the kids love the tech. They love a device that has no literal inputs, and they can thwack on it like a vending machine. but they don't understand the technology of it. It's the same thing I've worried about with the parents. I was the one setting and programming the VCR and doing all the tech stuff back in the house. They jumped over 25 years of tech to now have 21st century Star Trek devices in their hands. So I would argue, again, a lot of this is a bit of equal blame to share on both sides, the adults and the kids. I just retired after spending decades teaching an intro course at the university. The reason? Cheating is the norm and accepted. Critical thinking is out the door, and the use of ChatGPT is the only way students answer questions or write something. Kids can't tie their shoes anymore, not even the fifth graders. More and more, we're seeing kids lacking basic skills and teachers having to teach a class of 25-plus kids all at different levels. There's no way to do that well, and the kids just move on to the next grade even though they're far from ready. It's effed. I retired last year because the battle was bigger than me. Kids refused to think for themselves, and parents expected me to give grades for AI work. I guess what bothered me most was that they had no desire to learn, and they had no shame for being unlearned. So there were only 25 comments at first. Now there's 35 more, which is... how much, James?
Oh. Oh, God, don't put me on the spot. Wait, let me get my digital calculator. 20.
Yeah, or ask the browser.
I know. Low battery. Yeah. Okay, so you say that there's blame to go around, and I agree on that point, but I don't put the blame on the kids. Human beings are not fundamentally stupider or lazier than they have ever been throughout all of human history. And maybe they've always been stupid and lazy to some extent, but anyway. It's not that human beings are fundamentally genetically changing at the genomic level, at least not quite yet. But, yes, there is blame for what is happening with the degradation of basic life skills. And let's approach it from this way. People have heard of the Flynn effect, which is this long documented phenomenon of standardized IQ scores tending to go up decade after decade after decade after decade in an unbroken chain. It's people are getting smarter. Well, I guess that's one possible explanation for that. But then we have the reverse Flynn effect, which has kicked in arguably in the developed world since the 1990s as the standardized IQ scores start leveling off and even declining. So what is going on? People were getting smarter and smarter every decade, and now suddenly they're getting dumber and dumber every decade? No. We could take this, if you want it, from the hoity-toity science types. Flynn effect and its reversal are both environmentally caused, which was an article that was posted up a few years ago, which talks about this reverse Flynn effect. And it goes on to say, this establishes that the large changes in average cohort intelligence reflect environmental factors and not changing composition of parents, which in turn rules out several prominent hypotheses for retrograde Flynn effects. So in other words, please do go read through the article. But yes, no, it's not that people are getting fundamentally smarter or stupider. It's that environmental causes and inputs are the determinative factors in how we express ourselves as human beings, which should be obvious. So when we place children in situations where, for example, the helicopter parent phenomenon and the parent's going to be in charge of everything and do everything for the kids are going to learn that they can be completely helpless and, oh no, I'm just going to cry and scream until someone helps me put on my jacket. And if that is what we are teaching the kids, they will learn that. Now, you could argue, and some people might, that some of these things, well, of course, I know it's difficult for people of our vintage to comprehend this, but maybe there isn't something written in the stars about the value of being able to read a clock that has 12 digits, but we know that the shorthand has to be multiplied by 5. So, like, maybe that isn't the most important skill for a human being to have, unless we are in the analog world where everybody has analog clocks. So I'm not going to cry myself to sleep over a child that can't necessarily tell time on the clock. I mean, yeah, I get it, but it's not that important a skill. But it does point to something, which is that we are technologically determined. Yes, that is an important skill to have when there are analog clocks and everything is set up that way. But when we have digital clocks, maybe that is an important skill to have. But what else does that say about what skills are or are not important? If we are not teaching children to read physical, actual books that are written and printed and have, you know, all of the conventions of that format, then... of course, who cares? Whatever. I'm just typing emojis and and shorthand, and I use you, the letter U for Y-O-U and all of that. I mean, who cares? What does it matter? That's how everyone communicates. Our media is determinative of the things that we, the way that we interact with others, the things that we learn or don't learn, etc. So there's a lot to think about with regards to this. If people are interested in thinking about it, boy, have I got an online mass media history course for you that talks about the development from the printing press all the way up to 21st century metaverse technology and how that is shaping who we are as human beings. I think there's something very important going on here that's much beyond kids these days are dumb. So I hope people will take a look at that course and start to think about the ways the technology and the media are shaping who we are and whether maybe we don't want to go headfirst into this dumbing down of our children.
That is available at newworldnextweek.com. James and I get a lot of these stories doing Morning Monarchy, doing a live morning news show every day, and seeing these things about Gen Z getting fired months after getting hired because they don't show up and blah, blah, blah. They bring their parents with them on job interviews. Now, I was class clown, as is well established on this show. There was a certain point in high school, man, where I noticed they were putting me in the dummy class. I was like, oh no, I'm not dumb. I just don't care. And I really had to straighten up, and I joined a couple of clubs. It was like the panic of like, I hate all this and don't believe in it, but I sure as heck don't want to get left behind and not graduate and be a sad loser. Human authored, I believe, is the term you were looking for, James, when you were pointing to all your books behind you there. And that, these kids today, we can't even eat them. They're all so full of GMOs and Adderall. I'm just kidding. That's what a creepy eugenicist would say. Depopulation agenda architect Paul Ehrlich, dead at 93. He had a long, long run, grabbing this from Climate Depot. He said Western governments should end all food aid and argued for the forced sterilization of Indian men with three or more children. Paul Ehrlich, who has died at 93, was an entomologist specializing in butterflies, though he became better known as a campaigner for population control. In The Population Bomb, 1968, Ehrlich predicted imminent catastrophe as the result of human population growing faster than its ability to feed itself. In the 1970s, he proclaimed millions would starve to death as the weight of humanity bore down on the Earth's resources. 6 years later, in The End of Affluence in 74, written with his wife Anne, Ehrlich increased his death toll estimate, suggesting that a billion or more people could die from starvation by the mid-80s, and that by 1985, the world would be in an era of scarcity. When Thomas Malthus, writing an essay on the principle of population in 1798, predicted war, pestilence, and starvation as a result of overcrowding, the world's population stood at less than 1 billion. By the time Ehrlich joined the fray, it was 3.6 billion. Now it's a little over 8, they say. And as it has turned out, Ehrlich's population time bomb has failed to explode. Indeed, the death toll from famines has declined, even as the world's population has rocketed. And James, this was part of the talk in the 60s and 70s. There's that clip of, and I might be misreferencing, it's John Lennon on, I think, the Dick Cavett Show, and they're talking about overpopulation, and the host says, I think the world's overpopulated. John's like, well, I don't care, you know, I think you're wrong. He has a very flippant, you're wrong, but it's also a nice way for the guy who, of course, gets tagged with being the commie and Imagine and all that stuff, that he at least wasn't buying the overpopulation theory, as many of the left do. Again, any stand-up comedian, they all hate humanity and believe in population control. Paul Ehrlich's bad ideas won't go away, from The Spectator. China scrambles to reverse population collapse with effort to boost birth rates. The demographic winter, as we discussed here many, many times. And a couple of flashbacks. Episode 339, meet Paul Ehrlich, pseudoscience charlatan, and recall that Paul wrote the foreword to Make Room, the book that had nothing to do with cannibalism until the movie Malthusians got a hold of it and turned it into Soylent Green. That is one of our film, literature, and New World Order episodes, James. And there it is. I mean, we have seen, as things got crazy accelerated in the last decade since Trump and COVID and Trump 2.0, we've had a lot of the biggest boogeymen of alt media, 9/11 truth, all of that. But things have been so crazy, we don't even really have much time to stop and go, oh, that's right. David Rockefeller's, oh, Henry Kissinger's, oh, Brzezinski's, oh, man, Poppy Bush, all these dudes are gone. So there goes Paul Ehrlich at 93, James.
Yeah, and the irony is that they all get to live to their ripe old 80s, 90s, 100, because they live wonderful, pampered lives of abundance that they argued against in the case mm-hmm. of Ehrlich. Yeah, like, how dare you peasants and peons? You don't deserve all this abundance. But anyway, I'll live to the ripe old age of 93, being completely and totally, utterly, provably, demonstrably wrong about everything that he predicted, and yet still venerated and lauded to his dying day. I am at least can take the schadenfreude that he lived long enough to see the collapse of the Malthusian climate narrative garbage that is falling apart in front of our eyes after all these decades and decades of incessant propaganda and the concerted efforts of people like Ehrlich, but it's small comfort. And I will just throw a couple of relateds that I think are important. There's a good What's Up With That post. Ever Wrong Ehrlich's Greatest Hits, bracket or misses, which notes that the New York Times post on this, I haven't read it myself. I'm going to, but I don't want to subject myself to it. But apparently they write that, quote, his predictions proved premature. He's right. That's... he was a little too ahead of the curve, right? Everything he said, demonstrably, terribly wrong. Anyway, as one example in this article, they have a graph of famine deaths over the decades and this huge spike in the 1870s, presumably, is that the potato famine, etc., and all these, you know, famine deaths. And then, of course, 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, basically going down to as near zero as you're ever going to see. But yeah, of course, he was the one that was telling us we were all going to be completely out of food and we're all going to die in the 1970s, I think he was saying. They also have an excellent post I haven't seen before. In 1920, Scientific American called anthropogenic CO2 emissions, quote, the precious air fertilizer. And there's this great graphic here of the carbonic acid gas to fertilize the air, aka CO2 to fertilize the air. And they show potatoes grown with fertilized air, CO2 rich air, versus unfertilized air. And then you've got these gigantic, massive potatoes versus these tiny little. I mean, again, it was common knowledge a century ago, but they flipped it all on its head. And CO2 is the poisonous gas that we must eliminate because they know that it is good for the environment. Anyway, it's just part of the craziness. And another good thing that people should read at masterresource.org, there's a post, The Special Case of Paul Ehrlich, which is Julian Simon, who was writing, I think, in the 1990s about Ehrlich and how Ehrlich completely and totally and utterly dismissed Simon and called him a kook and wouldn't debate him, et cetera, et cetera. But people might remember the bet of the century that Simon made with Ehrlich, and Simon won, Ehrlich lost. But of course, nobody cares. Nobody didn't change anything. And the New York Times still lauds him as being premature. He was premature on his predictions. Anyway, read that post if you want some more of the details. But I think this is an important, as you say, a good signpost, a good part, marking point along our path. That, of course, we're not going to see any sort of justice to these people who have inflicted so much damage on the world through their horrible, evil, life-denying, humanity-hating narratives. But at the very least, some of them are living long enough to see that narrative collapsing before their eyes. So I'll take that as a small win.
There'll be Gatorade in the water fountains before you know it. You think Paul Ehrlich was doom scrolling on his device there till the end, looking at how wrong he was and how, I don't know, good grief. You know, and remember, it was a different Paul Krugman making predictions, you know, that this whole life-changing, world-changing thing we call the internet has turned out to be a little more important than the fax machine, indeed. Hey, I mentioned it earlier. Go to newworldnextweek.com. Media Monarchy, Corbett gear, hats, shirts, hoodies, DVDs, radio plays, educational downloads. And again, the downloads are great, James, because we don't have to ship anything out. It doesn't require a bunch of other middlemen. You buy it, you get it, you download it, and you're learning there in a few moments. And don't forget about the post office box that I have here in New Mexico. If you want to support myself or James Corbett, you can send, of course, to the P.O. Box. We'll have always that in the show notes. And we also have a combined nearly 40 years of our work, James. Good grief. And I get the exclusive audio of these New World Next Week episodes. Before we publish them, I get to play the audio on my radio stream. And that is... Now I'm coughing this week. And that is, of course, at MediaMonarchy.com/listen. You get to hear my real sort of radio style.
Yeah.
Where I don't, awesome, where I don't cough.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, let me just reinforce the show notes idea for people. If people don't use the show notes, you're doing New World Next Week wrong. There are lots and lots and lots of articles and links that we are in every single edition of New World Next Week that will be plenty more learning for you than what we can encapsulate here in just this episode. So please do make your use of the show notes. And yes, the mail, P.O. Box are always there in the show notes if you want to support the work that way. So thank you, James, for doing what you do. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, buddy. You know, I'd throw in real quick, I make the kind of work that I would want to consume. And so when I'm on YouTube, and that's the place, you know, you got to click the more button to show the drop down where all the notes and all the links are. What do you usually find when you click more on most other video uploads? Here's all the links to all my other crap, and here's my bunch of sweatshop garbage. It's all just hype, hype, hype. When you click more on our video uploads, which now have the Media Monarchy and Corbett Report channels that you can subscribe to both, I'm going to crack 26,000, I think, at some point, hopefully, maybe. When you click more on New World Next Week, you will find the wealth of all the work that we're trying to do for you, James. There it is, man.
That's it. Awesome. Let's keep doing it. James, thanks for the stories.
Thanks, buddy. Take care.
Take care.